Good evening, everybody. We're going to continue our Kilche topic on the Zen Circle and some of the sources that provided the information that went into producing the Zen Circle. I've just passed around a copy of the Zen Circle that's just been stripped of everything except the stuff that is from the sutra we're going to talk about tonight, which is the awakening of faith in the Mahayana. The awakening of faith in the Mahayana is a extremely profound sutra for our teaching. It brings out some points for the first time that are just paramount. We refer to them over and over again in the interview room and in our discussions, and those things are substance, truth, and function. And it also brings out the absolute world and relative world. It appeared in China in the 6th century, and it was attributed to a great Indian scholar, Avaghosha. But modern scholarship, they don't think that he actually was the one that wrote it. I think it was originated in China in the 6th century. By the time D.T. Suzuki made his translation and published it in 1900, there were about 300 commentaries on this sutra. So it's very well-loved and commented on and passed around sutra. In the 6th century, there was a Chinese master by the name of Fei Zhen, and he had a summary of the discourse, or the summary of this sutra. He called it a discourse on one mind, two aspects, three greatnesses, four faiths, and five practices. And we won't be going into all that today. We'll just be talking about the one mind, two gates, and the three greatnesses. Well, the sutra, it can be the title of it can be translated in a few different ways. Hakata translated it as the awakening of faith. Suzuki translated it as discourse on the awakening of faith in the Mahayana. And then a recent translation by Jorgensen and friends translated it as treatise on awakening the Mahayana faith. So you can see the word Mahayana appears in the title, in several of these titles. And it's not how we normally think of the word Mahayana. Normally, when you think of Mahayana, you think of it as Mahayana Buddhism as contrast with Hinayana Buddhism. But here, that's not really what the meaning of Mahayana is. It's more of a meaning of suchness, of substance. So Hakata said, well, you could probably better translate the title of this as the awakening of faith in the absolute, or awakening of faith in suchness. And that's really starting to hit at one of the real important points of this sutra, which is substance and awakening to that. Now, we've all heard stories of Wan Ho, and he's famous for lots of stuff. And one of the things he was well known for was his excellent commentaries. He was a very good scholar, and he would comment on many different sutras. And his commentary style was a little bit different than a lot of people. He didn't comment line by line by line. He zeroed in on the meaning, the important meanings, and then went more into depth about certain topics that really spoke to him. I think that's a really interesting and a good way of doing it. He wrote a commentary on the treatise of the Awakening Mahayana Faith, and this was a very highly esteemed commentary. It really influenced the Zen in China. Zen kind of started in China and then went to Korea and Japan and Asia. But Wan Ho, his insightful commentaries really fed back into China and influenced the development of Chan there. Well, at one point in Juan Ho's career, he decided to go visit, go on a pilgrimage to Tang, China, because there was a great scholar there that had been in India for 17 years doing studies of Buddhism. And so Juan Ho was, you know, a very sincere, devout student of Buddhism. So he wanted to go to China to meet with this teacher and learn from him. So he and a colleague, another monk, Yusong, they set off to study there with this Swang Seng, who was the guy that had been in India for 17 years. And the story that appears from his journeys to China is this enlightenment story. You've all heard some versions of it, but there's a version here that ties in really directly to the awakening of faith. And I'll just read that. So when Wan Hyo and Yusong arrived at their port of embarkation, their ship's departure was delayed by inclement weather. But, you know, isn't that something? Just going to China was not a sure bet. It was a dangerous journey, you know. I mean, this was not the Queen Mary or anything. So anyway, they went to the port to leave, and there was really bad weather. So they were caught in the rain without a place to stay, and they took shelter in a nearby cave where they found gourds from which to drink, and so were able to get a decent night's sleep. In the light of dawn, they realized that the cave in which they were staying was actually a tomb, and the gourds from which they drank were human skulls. The storm continued, delaying their departure for another day, and they were forced to spend another night in the cave. During the second night, they did not have any success in sleeping. They had a miserable night. They were plagued by ghosts and nightmares. And then Juan Ho reflected on this experience. He suddenly became deeply aware of the extent to which his perception of the world was based on the limits of his own mind. He experienced a great awakening to the principle of consciousness only, after which he decided there was, after all, there's no need for me to go to China. I've got it now. I'm going back to Silla. Forget the boat ride. He explained his experience thus: because of the arising of thought, various phenomena arise. Since thought ceases, a cave and a grave are not two. That's a reference to a verse in the Awakening of Faith that says, when a thought arises, all dharmas arise. And when a thought ceases, all dharmas cease. Now, you might have heard another version of this story, which I think speaks a little bit louder to the idea of consciousness only. And in this story, when Wan Ho awoke in the morning and saw what he drank and looked in the skull, and it was just putrid, full of bugs and flesh, and then he threw up. And as he was throwing up, he had this great awakening that all things are created by mind alone. But in this version, it talked about he realized that the cave and the grave, or the tomb, were not two. And so that's a very important theme, not two. We'll see a little bit more of that in a moment. So one aspect in the sutra, the Awakening of Faith, is this idea of one mind and two gates. I'll just quote from the sutra here. There are two gateways based on the Dharma of the one mind. What are they? The first is the gateway of the mind as suchness. The second is the gateway of the mind as arising and ceasing. Each of these two gateways contains all dharmas. Why? Because these two gateways are not separate from one another. So the gate of the mind as suchness is referring to substance, to the absolute. And the gate of the mind as arising and ceasing is referring to the relative world, to the phenomenal world. And he said these are gateways are not separate from one another. We can see the absolute world, because the mind of arising and ceasing, our ordinary everyday mind, is not separate from the absolute world. They're not two. So we have these two gates. Do these, the gate of the mind is suchness and is arising and ceasing. Are these two gates real? Do they exist? They don't really exist. And why not? Because they are not two. Now, the absolute. How do we see the absolute? We've all gotten a lot of good instruction on that. And our technique, if you will, is meditation based. We sit without conceptualizing the experience, without thinking about this or that, sitting with don't know mind, sit with spacious awareness of present moment reality. Then it's all right here, right now. We can see. We can look, we can behold. It's all right here. There's no need to look anywhere else for it. And actually, if you do try and look for it somewhere else, you definitely won't find it. In the Zen circle, the right half, from 0 to 180, that's the relative world. And then the left half, from 180 down to 360, that's the absolute world, the world of suchness. Several enlightenment stories have been handed down to us over the years. And in some of these enlightenment stories, there's talk about three different levels of enlightenment. And I was kind of leery about getting into that because it's an area where we can get tripped up on it. We can start seeking after things or just giving them more due. But these stories do talk about these three different levels, and so it's kind of important. The three levels of enlightenment correspond to a realization of substance. They correspond to a realization of truth and to a realization of function. Those are the three levels of enlightenment. Zen Master Sungsan wrote that these three levels of enlightenment are called first enlightenment, original enlightenment, and final enlightenment. But, like I said, don't get hung up on the words or give too much to it. First enlightenment is attaining true emptiness. Original enlightenment is attaining truth. And final enlightenment is attaining function. But don't think final enlightenment is final. After you get final enlightenment, then what? Then just begin again with the new moment. And then what? And then begin again with the new moment. Over and over again. Always a beginning. The sutra talks about substance, truth, and function as the three meanings of maha, or great, of the great vehicle. And quoting from the sutra, the meaning of Mahayana is disclosed on the basis of this mind. Why? Because the aspect of this mind as suchness directly reveals Mahayana's intrinsic reality. And because the aspect of this mind as the cause and condition of arising and ceasing is the revealer of Mahayana's own intrinsic reality, characteristics, and function. So, substance, truth, and function. It said Because the aspect of this mind as the cause and condition of arising and ceasing. So that's just the ordinary mind. That ordinary mind is the revealer of Mahayana's own intrinsic reality and characteristics or truth and function. So that again is pointing out that this mind of arising and ceasing of the relative world reveals substance, the absolute world. There's no need to look for substance, the absolute, outside of ordinary mind. It's right here. The sutra goes on to say, these are the three meanings of Maha, great, in the world, in the word Mahayana, great vehicle. What are they? The first is that Mahayana's intrinsic reality is great because the suchness of all dharmas is uniform, neither increasing or decreasing. So that's referring to substance. The second is that its characteristics are great because the Tathagata Garbha, that's Buddha nature, is replete with countless merits. So that's referring to truth. And the third is that its functions are great because it is the producer of all good causes and effects, both mundane and supramundane. That's referring to function. This is why the Mahayana, the great vehicle, is that on which all Buddhas have always ridden and why all Buddhas ride on this Dharma until they arrive at the level of Tathagatas. So those three meanings of Maha, which is substance, truth, and function, bodhisattvas ride that until they arrive at the level of Tathagata. So to be fully awake, we have to realize all three of those. Substance, truth, and function. Now some more on substance. Since substance is the absolute, any concept of it is going to totally miss the mark. A master said the closest thing to it is don't know, or beginner's mind. There's another great Korean master, Master Sosan. He was born in 1520. And he wrote this little book called The Mirror of Zen. And he wrote about why he did it. He said, the writings, meaning all the sutras, are too extensive. And the sea of sutras is so vast. I was afraid that fellow practitioners in the future might have to take unnecessary pains to weed through so many branches in order to gather the fruits that would truly nourish them. So in order to save students of the Dharma from the needless effort and trouble, I've selected here in one book a few hundred words from the writings that are the most essential and inspiring of faith and practice. The writings are spare, even deceptively simple, but their meanings are perfectly clear. So it's this this tiny book that Zen Master Sosong wrote, and it really has a hugely profound impact on our practice, because when you read that book, and then you read Sung-Song's stuff, there's just so much connection there. But I brought up that book just because we're talking about substance right now, and he's got a short chapter on substance, so I'll let him do the talking instead of me. It's the very first chapter in this book, and I'll read it in its entirety. There's only one thing from the very beginning, infinitely bright and mysterious by nature. It was never born, and it never dies. It cannot be described or given a name. Then there's a commentary. What is this one thing? And in the book, he drew an enso. An eminent teacher wrote, even before the ancient Buddhas were born, one thing was already perfectly complete. Even Shakyamuni Buddha could not understand it. How could he transmit it to Mahakashyapa? Then Sosong goes on to say, there is one thing that is never born and never dies. For this reason, it can't be named in any way or expressed or depicted. And then he has a little story. The sixth patriarch of Zen once addressed the assembly thus, I have something that has no name and no form. Do any of you see it? Zen master Shen Hui immediately replied, it is the essence of all Buddhas and also my Buddha nature. Due to this answer, Shen Hui cannot be considered a legitimate heir and descendant of the sixth patriarch. Zen master Nanwei came from Mount Sungsong to see the sixth patriarch, who asked, what is it that comes here like this? Nanwei was completely stuck and could not answer anything. After 8 years of practice, he finally attained enlightenment and said, if you even call this a thing, it is not correct. This answer is why Nanwei thus became the premier Dharma heir and successor of the sixth patriarch. And there's a gatha at the end. The sages of the three great teachings can be found in this phrase. Who dare express it must be careful. Your eyebrows might fall out. So the sages of the three great teachings, that is the Buddha and Confucius and Lao Tzu. And then he says, all three of them had an understanding of substance. And then he says, who dare express it must be careful, your eyebrows may fall out. In Asia, there's a fable that your eyebrows will fall out as a consequence of lying. It's kind of like Pinocchio's nose growing. So this is kind of a warning about talking about substance too much, trying to conceptualize it. Like you said, it cannot be named in any way or expressed and depicted. And yet, here I am talking about it, reading this thing here. There's a saying, open mouth is already a mistake. But then there's another saying, you have to say something. But when you're talking about substance, just be very careful what you say. Now, there's a risk about getting attached to the experience of substance, the experience of suchness, of the absolute. And that's a big mistake. Many teachers have addressed it, and one of them was Wuman, the Gateless Gate, 48 Kung-on collection, the Gateless Barrier. At the Wuman had a great introduction to the Kung-ons, and then at the end he had a little set of warnings that's really good too. And in one of those, he says, to maintain the mind in solitary depths is the specious Zen of quietism. So the definition of specious, according to Merriam-Webster, is having a false look of truth for genuineness, having deceptive allure or attraction. So he's warning us off of getting attached to emptiness. That's not a good thing. If you have a profound experience of emptiness and peacefulness, that's great. But when it goes, let it go. Throw it away and just move on. Substance in the Zen circle is at 180 degrees. Zen Master Sung-san said the experience of substance occurs in two different ways, and he called those two different ways without like this and become one like this. Without like this is complete stillness. As Sosan said, there's one thing from the very beginning, infinitely bright and mysterious. It was never born and never dies. It's just still, never changing. The Mahaparinirvana Sutra has a line about the without like this point, without like this experience of emptiness. It says, when appearing and disappearing disappear, this stillness is bliss. So that's a reference to without like this. During an interview, if you needed to express a without like this answer, what would that be? It'd be stillness. Just sitting, stillness. Then the other 180-point experience is become one like this. And that's demonstrating substance. A become one like this answer would be hitting the floor, you know, or a Zen shout, or drawing an enso. One of the first instructions we get in our interviews is when a Kangana question is asked, what's our first response? And that's, you know, to hit the floors in recognition of the absolute. And this idea of starting that answer with hitting the floor, this is something, a practice you can take into your everyday life as well. Maybe not hitting the floor, but the idea of before you move on with something, reground yourself into, you know, the absolute. Think back on it, flash to it, whatever works for you to just reconnect with it. Okay, the next part is truth. And truth is everything that you see or feel or touch or smell or taste. All of this is truth. Well, what are we talking about? I mean, I knew that when I was a kid, right? But there's a bit of a difference between a diluted truth and a truth that's experienced it as we're expressing, or as the sutra is expressing. There's some differences, and one difference between a diluted perception of the truth and the enlightened perception of the truth, it has to do with non-attachment. There's a saying about the great round mirror. It has no likes or dislikes. When black appears in front of it, the mirror reflects black. It doesn't attach to it. When black leaves and white comes, it reflects white. It doesn't pick and choose. And in the same way, at 360, the truth world, is when we look at things without that attachment. Just whatever is there, we reflect it and we see it. We don't push away something we don't like, and we don't cling to something that we do like when it leaves. Another difference between delusion and truth is conceptual thinking. Instead of just experiencing something and seeing it as it is, you start to define it with words and concepts. And then before long, we're thinking of the concept is reality when it's just a concept. There's a pretty famous saying by an old master, Qiyan Wing Xing, that's about realizing substance and truth. Before I studied Zen for 30 years, I saw mountains and mountains and waters as waters. When I arrived at a more intimate knowledge, I came to the point where I saw that mountains are not mountains and waters are not waters. But now that I have got its very substance, I am at rest. For it's just that I see mountains once again as mountains, and waters once again as waters. So that he started out, you know, down there in zero, just ordinary diluted mind, waters, mountains or mountains. Then he came up to the absolute, the 180 point to substance, and mountains are not mountains, waters are not waters. Then he came back down around to 360. And once again, mountains are mountains and waters are waters. So is there any difference between the mountains and waters at zero and the mountains and waters at 360? There's no difference at all. The mountain is still the mountain and the waters are still the waters. The difference is in his mind, in how he is perceiving them, just directly, without clinging and without concept, or as a concept. Zen Master Sing Song called truth only like this, which is kind of hard to remember. So we've updated it and we just call it truth world. A little more meaningful. So if you're in an interview and a question was asked that needs a truth world answer, what would that be? And, you know, the Casa is brown. And last but not least, function. So attaining substance and truth are important, but they're not enough. They're insufficient to be fully awake. Our practice is incomplete if we just stop there. And as the warning said, you know, don't become attached to substance, because you'll be stuck there. How do we use truth? What's the function of truth? And a bodhisattva is going to use truth to save all beings from suffering. Perceive the situation, you know, with perceive the truth and your relationship, and then act or don't act in accordance with the needs of the situation. Remember what the sutra said, the words it used when it was talking about function, about the greatness of it. It said, functions are great because it is the producer of all good causes and effects. So that's an important point. Function is not just willy-nilly. It's has a specific direction of some kind of wholesome, good, beneficial behavior, something that's beneficial to ourselves and to others. Zen Master Sung Song called function just like this, and that's another one that's kind of hard to remember, so we call it moment world or action. So function is also at 360. Both truth and function are at 360. So the truth world answer in an interview would be like, my casa is brown. What would a moment world response be? And, you know, is that a cup or not a cup? So the key points are the mind of suchness, the absolute world, and the mind of phenomena, the relative world, are not two. You can attain them right here, right now, with the ordinary mind. Remember, the mind of arising and ceasing is the gateway to substance, truth, and function. And then to fully wake up, these three, substance, truth, and function, must all be realized. There's a primer from the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center that supplies a deconstruction of the sutra, and then refers to page numbers in the...
It can't hear you.
Oh. Thank you. It refers to page numbers in the Awakening of Faith, so you can bounce back and forth and see. So if you wanted to study further, that source is a good one. And then there are a couple other translations, Jorgensen and D.T. Suzuki, and I really like that Jorgensen. It was the most recent one. So that's that. Any questions, folks?
So the tape recorder couldn't hear you, but when you were doing the function thing regarding talking about function, what a function answer might be in regards to the cup, right after you picked it up to show it to us, you took a sip of water and then you put it down.
They got it. Question.
So I just love the, I guess it's almost like this question, what is the awakening of faith? And it's always been in Zen for me one of those trickier kinds of points in religion. Oh, ye of little faith, you know, you just must believe that everything will be fine. And so in this context, I'm curious from your reading, what does the awakening of faith mean?
You know, it's the faith part I didn't get so much. But the awakening...
It's only the title of it.
Yeah. But the... maybe the faith is more like... To me, it was like awakening to the absolute. And whatever word you want to put in between awakening and absolute...
Maybe the connectedness.
Yeah. You know, something like that.
I might add a comment.
Yes, thank you.
Because it's a question that's come up a fair amount about this term faith that is somewhat harsh in our Western world. And, you know, we've looked at it more in terms of opening oneself up completely to the process. So that, in a sense, Chenul, this another great master from Korea, talked about the awakening of that open trust in the process as actually the first enlightenment experience that comes before any other. You know how that is. Do you dare to go in all the way? So that's what this, I think, is referring to.
Yes.
So is substance like a synonym for emptiness, or are those two terms directing us to different things?
That's a really good question. You know, because substance, we talk about emptiness at 180, but then there are some things about substance when you really are looking at substance and not how it's manifest in this world, but just stepping back, you know, it doesn't increase or decrease. It's always there. So they're kind of saying that substance isn't really empty. It's something else.
That's all clear to me now.
All the words in those guys.
Yeah.
They're kind of like pointing to the same thing, but can't say that.
But having said that, too, you know, we talk very much about the, you know, emptiness at 180. And that's a, you know, with our meditation practice and opening up to seeing things and seeing impermanence and interdependence, you know, which is all around us, you know, for the taking. You can see this all the time. Those lead to an understanding of emptiness, which is a much maligned word, too, the way that was translated, because you think, well, is that like, you know, nihilism, you know, annihilation? And it's, you know, one way it's been explained is things are empty of any enduring nature. And that's one way of looking at it for sure. And another way is emptiness just contains the potential for everything. And when you look at it that way, it becomes less of a scary thing and more of a beautiful thing.
I want to ask about the faith also. I think it's so interesting. I think it takes a leap of faith to look at things in a different way. I think, you know, I mean, this practice, you know, it requires us to not think about things in the same way we've always thought about it, which is scary. and that requires some faith that it's going to be okay for us to change our point of view on our perspective on something. And you know, when you go into, you know, when you sit and you decide you're not gonna hold on to this, to the way you've always thought about things, but leave it open to whatever happens in the moment, I mean, that means that anything can happen in your mind. And I think that requires a great deal. I'm sorry, it wasn't really a question. agree. Yeah, there are these.
No, we were at the last book club that we were talking about that scariness of, you know, just opening up to things. And For seasoned practitioners, you know, it's not a scary thing. But then, you know, there are people in the world that their whole worldview will just get knocked out from under them, and it would be an extremely traumatic experience. You know, so I can understand why some people would be afraid. They built this thing up that's just not true, and they're resting on it, and it'd be scary to lose it. That's, you know, function. How do you approach people, you know, with the particular need that they have? And how do you help? Sometimes it's, as Sung Song would say, more suffering is needed. Yeah, they the sutra is pretty clear about that, because it's in a line. I don't know if I have that line in here, but the first is the gateway of the mind is suchness, and the second is the gateway of mind is arising and ceasing. So there's it's contrasting suchness with the relative world. I believe there's another place in there too, and it surprised me too, because I always thought of suchness as, you know, right here, right now. But I guess it is in a way too, isn't it? You know, yeah. The view into the absolute is right here in this relative, nominal world that we're sitting in.